by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make the heaven the middle of it. Rest make the heaven the middle. We are rest make the
secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot to cover this evening. We've got Mark Carney out here in Jackson Hole meeting, saying that they're going to introduce a synthetic hegemonic money. Now, what the heck is that? But anyway, we have him being interviewed right now. Listen to what this guy has to say. He's director of the Bank of England, and he's had very high positions at the Bank of International Settlements. He shows up every year at the Bilderberg Group. He's a mover and shaker. And now, coming out of the Bank of England, we're going to have a synthetic hegemonic money. So listen to this interview, see what you think.
Thanks very much, Melissa. Here at Jackson Hole with Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England. Mark, President Trump today escalated tariffs. China escalated tariffs. President Trump escalated. Talk about the global effects of this trade war between the U.S. and China.
Well, obviously can't comment on just today's effects, but if we take a step back, what's been happening is there's been the direct effects between the U.S. and the U.K., the U.S. and China, of the actual tariffs. And, you know, they're starting to get up towards potentially over the course of a 2-3 year period, about 1 percentage point lower for U.S. GDP if they all remain in place. So there's the direct effects. But what's happening globally is a confidence effect on business confidence, not just in the U.S. and China, but all across those supply chains and then more broadly, because it's not, as you know, just a series of measures between those jurisdictions. We've had issues with USMCA. We have issues around auto. We have still have issues around steel. We have issues in terms of the technology complex, if I can put it that way. And those effects are at least as material as the direct trade effects, and those effects are impacting all of the economies around the world. And that's what's starting to happen. And so now that's starting to play into the outlook for the global economy. And whether you're directly involved or not, it is impinging on the outlook. And, for example, for the U.K., it's starting to affect our outlook.
I want to get back to that. I think people need to understand you were the governor of Bank of Canada, before that Goldman Sachs, and played a critical role in the global central banking response to the crisis. So I'm teeing that background up for the next question, which is, are global central banks, do they have the tools to address the fallout from an extended trade war? And how well are they positioned right now to address overall global economic weakness?
Well, let me start with the second bit, yeah, which is that we obviously have less policy room than we did in 2008, or even than we did several years ago. Rates are very low. Certain countries are doing the quantitative easing, so there is less room. The central bank, the major central bank with the most room, is the Fed because of the strength of the U.S. economy. So we have less room, but we do have room, and we do have an ability to use that room. The judgment has to be is when do you deploy that firepower? The question that's beginning to emerge because of the scale of the trade effects is, are a number of central banks going to ease policy for their own reasons? And then collectively, will that provide an offset? Now, the one thing that won't happen is that changing the level of the bank rate in the UK, for example, doesn't change materially the cost of capital for a business in the UK, and certainly not a business in the US or elsewhere. 25 basis points doesn't make a difference there. What it can make a difference to, though, is demand in the UK and demand in other jurisdictions, and it's that effect which also provides some stimulus. So the direct effects, not just of the tariffs, but I really would emphasize the uncertainty that is being created by this the series of measures that are happening, and happening in a way that is somewhat unpredictable.
So we have our set of problems that you say we've shipped to you. You have your set of problems, which Fed Chairman Jerome Powell mentioned today,
yeah.
Brexit as being an issue for the United States. I want to ask you if you can be sure to keep your problems over there, but I don't think that's the right question. How much has it affected the UK? Is it substantially responsible for the negative second quarter outcome that you had in your growth numbers? And do you foresee that continuing?
Yeah, okay. Well, there's two things. Yeah, the short answer to the question is yes. But let me break it into two parts, which is in the very short term, the first quarter was a little stronger than people would have expected. Second quarter is negative. Third quarter is going to be, we think, is going to be positive. But the underlying pace of growth is relatively weak. That up and down between those various quarters, those are companies building inventories in the first quarter because they thought there might be trade disruption, running them down in the second quarter, the auto plants doing the same thing, and then knock-on effects in the third quarter. It's noise. It's real activity, but it's noise in terms of the underlying pace of growth in the economy. Now, let me step back to the second bit, which is how's the UK economy doing? Since the referendum, it's done pretty well. We've got unemployment at rates, you know, lowest in 45 years. Wages are growing just south of 4%. Inflation's basically at target. Business investment, and all of that has happened in a world where there's been a lot of uncertainty because of Brexit and what shape it's going to take. It's an analogy to the trade war. This gets to what we were talking about a moment ago in terms of, well, what can monetary policy do in those circumstances? Well, what we did in the UK was after the referendum, because we thought there'd be uncertainty. We brought them down.
Right.
We did a variety of things, and that has supported other aspects of the economy. Now, well, business investment is actually running almost 25 percentage points below its previous trend. Businesses in the UK have quite reasonably said, wait a minute, I'm going to wait until, if they have any exposure to Europe, either upstream or downstream, they've decided to wait and see, well, what are the new rules of the game going to be? And see,
that's
part of what's happening worldwide is people are saying, well, okay, well, I've got exposure to a Chinese supply chain or U.S. Let me see where this settles out. And that's why it's having a bigger effect.
I have to ask a direct question here. You only have 75 basis points of ammunition left in your primary tool, your interest rate. So it looks like you've been stubbornly holding on to that. Is that ammunition you're holding on to in case there's a hard Brexit?
Well, no, two things. There's a couple of paths the UK economy can take. There's at least three. One is there's a deal. And there's a deal, and some degree of that economic relationship, deep economic relationship, is retained. Now, in that world, we're starting from basically at full employment, inflation at target, businesses with a lot of firepower on their own balance sheets, good financial conditions, and we're likely to see some of the catch-up of that investment there and the economy pick up. That's a world, I know it doesn't fit with the theme of the day, where actually we probably would be raising interest rates at a limited, you know, limited pace, gradual extent, vice versa, but you get the point. Now, in a world where there's no deal and there's no transition, the other extreme, which is a possibility, not a given, but a possibility. Then in that world, we would expect that we're going to lose demand from Europe in the short term. There'll probably be an adjustment domestically as well, consumer spending. So demand goes down. We'll have to make a judgment in that world because the supply capacity of the economy will also go down. Because this is an economy that's very well integrated to Europe, and it's going to take a while. British businesses are very flexible, labor market's flexible, but you got to redeploy that. That takes some time, and so it's the balance of those two effects. On balance, I've said this before, my personal view is we probably would ease in that world, that scenario, but it's not a given, and it depends on how it shakes out.
So, changing gears, last issue, Governor Carney, I really appreciate your time and thoughts on this. You dropped a bombshell in the luncheon there. That's the way I was described. It's almost like a mic drop. You are exiting this job, almost like a mic drop. And you said we need to go to a global virtual currency. It's a 23-page speech. It's very heavy. Give us the thumbnail.
Did you just read the conclusion of the speech, Steve?
No, I read 14 pages,
okay,
and then
good.
I jumped
okay,
to the
okay.
conclusion.
So what's the point?
Give us the thumbnail. Why can't the dollar be the global currency?
Okay, the dollar is the global currency. We know that. The challenge is that the U.S. share of the global economy has been reducing. The dollar's share of payments, not just financial assets, but payments. A lot of payments between countries that have nothing to do with the U.S. are in dollars. And what happens in situations like we're in today, where the U.S. economy, to its credit, is relatively strong, is doing better, and the Fed has been doing the right thing, which is, you know, they've adjusted policy, they tightened policy as it was strengthening. Now they're making, you know, the Fed doing the right thing, but they have adjusted and policy is relatively strong. That means rest of world policy is strong, is tighter than it needs to be, and that feeds back on the U.S. economy in a way that ultimately slows this economy, and it leads to a substandard outcome. And in a world where you only have limited policy space, it's a dangerous place to be. And it's so the trade issues we're talking about are reinforced by the structure of the monetary system. Now, I mean, you've asked a big question, so just give me a second to. But now the issue is, you don't just jump to something new overnight. And the what we want in a multipolar world, I think we'd agree that we've got European engine, we've got the Chinese engine, we've got the U.S. engine of this economy, multipolar world, you need a multipolar currency. The question is, how do you get there? And I laid out some ideas of how you would get there.
And the bottom line, Governor, is that all of the pressure on the different in growth around the world would not fall on the dollar exchange rate.
Yeah.
It would be spread out if it was a global basket of currencies.
It would be spread out. It was a global basket of currencies. It's better for the system as a whole. It's better. It raises that equilibrium level of interest rates.
Right.
It gives central banks more policy, but it gives people who are watching greater returns on their savings.
Well, certainly we're thinking about it. Governor Carney, thanks
all
for
right.
joining us.
Thanks
and
for having
good
me.
Luck through the Brexit process, the trade wars, and the growth issues out there.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks very much. Back to you guys. I guess you're in Englewood Cliffs right now.
We're at the NASDAQ. It's a long list of things.
NASDAQ.
To wish him well on. Steve, thank you. Steve Leisman with the Bank of England, Governor Mark Carney. Mike, what do you make of this in the prism of the most recent ramp up in trade tensions with China?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things he just said, which I found it kind of interesting myself, is he was just talking about how central banks and maybe the Fed have less basically wiggle room or ability now than they had perhaps before the credit crisis. I'm not entirely sure that that's true. We have to first think about how much of an impact we think Fed can have and what are we actually talking about them trying to mitigate. Is it an issue of trying to support, GDP in the United States? Are we trying to focus on employment? Are we trying to focus on inflation? Are we trying to focus on asset prices? I mean, that's what we're usually talking about on this show, right? I think it's kind of interesting because, of course, we've seen unconventional policy. And when you have unconventional policy like QE, then I'm not 100% sure that they don't have a lot of latitude. I'm not suggesting that. I'm not sure I want to see us go back to that. I certainly hope we don't need to. But I think that when we have unconventional policy that we can implement, there is a lot of room. There's almost unlimited room.
So basically just thinking about the amount you can cut, that's deceptive because there's a little
entirely deceptive
tools.
That's right.
Right. We can reverse course in the balance sheet, I suppose,
exactly.
Right? That would be another tool. But remember, the magnitude of what we were facing in 08, maybe we had more tools, but the magnitude of the crisis was, this is nothing remotely close to that. But one thing that I thought was interesting that he said, just thinking about Brexit as sort of a, not that much of a microcosm, a smaller version mm-hmm. of our trade. You have a lot of uncertainty there, right? You have a date that might be certain, but you don't know how it's going to shake out.
Right.
And they are the fifth largest economy in the world. So that'll be interesting to see. The point that I thought was interesting, he talked about business investment being down 25%. We haven't seen that here, but that's where I'm afraid that uncertainty creates uncertainty. I'd much rather have a deal, even if it's not a great deal. I'd even rather have less back and forth, you know, just, I guess it seems to me the actions haven't been so well thought out.
Right.
And that, I wish that were not the case. I think the president does himself
a disservice,
particularly because he cares about the market.
One of the things that keeps, our economy strong, obviously we have to focus on what's going on the business side, business investment and so on. And obviously, decision makers are going to want to have at least some clarity, some kind of a path ahead. And when you have absolutely no idea which direction you're going to lurch in next, that's actually what jeopardizes. It's not the magnitude of the tariffs necessarily that
right.
upsets me. It's what worries me is decision making that has much greater magnitude than the tariffs would.
Kyle Bass is stating that Hong Kong right now is undergoing a great financial change, is that the Chinese have created other ports besides Hong Kong. Hong Kong used to be the main port for mainland China for shipping. Now that's been reduced down to 2 or 3%. And the Chinese have other ports. Also, there could be a possible problem with the Hong Kong dollar coming up in the future with a rainy day fund down to 20% of what it was, say, 2 years ago. So anyway, listen carefully to Kyle Bass. He has a lot to say about the Hong Kong situation. But on top of this, then we have the protesting going on in Hong Kong because of the extradition treaty and so forth. So Hong Kong's in for mucho problems. Here we go now.
The 10-year period from 08 to 2018 were the best 10 years that Hong Kong will ever see. It will never happen again. The Hong Kong banking system is now almost 9 times their GDP.
Wow.
Of the, call it today, it's 850% of GDP. 280% of GDP of the 850 is lent to Chinese property developers into China. They're the most levered nation in the world, with the most expensive real estate in the world, with an economic arrangement with a country that is no longer synchronized. It is a recipe for disaster.
If you remember, a month ago, Kyle Bass was on Real Vision talking about China, and he said he had one big trade for us, the really big one, the one that he'd been doing all of his work on, and he refused to unveil it until he told his investors and got himself kind of set up and positioned. That moment's now. Kyle's back to come and tell us the next big trade, the trade that he thinks is one of the greatest opportunities in financial markets. It's going to be super interesting for us all to sit back and watch Kyle Bass unveil this great idea. So Kyle, you've come with a tie. I've got my collars up. What you promised me a month ago is you're going to come with the killer trade, the big idea that you've been working on for a while ago, and we kind of alluded it on Real Vision to people, and now you're back and you're ready to kind of unveil what is, you and I have spoken about it a little bit, and it's, for me, fascinating and almost incredible.
I appreciate
that. Talk me through it.
Let's start at the beginning. So, you know, for the last really 3 years, we've focused on, as you know, I don't know, there's 6 or 7 years, we focused on China's financial system.
Yeah.
And that's taken us to understanding the flows and the plumbing of capital and how it flows in and out of China, whether you're looking at Hong Kong or China, or you're looking at the listed market or the domestic market in China, the majority of the capital flows through Hong Kong. And when you look at Hong Kong as a sovereign, you know, I'll tell a little bit of a story as far as the existence of Hong Kong in its economic and financial state that it's
right.
in today. You have to look back 36 years. You really have to look back much further than that when, you know, the UK or Great Britain really fought a couple of wars, the first and second opium wars, and then the balance for the new territories and, you know, took over Hong Kong Island, Kowloon, and the new territories. And they basically ruled those territories for a very long time. And at some point in time, in the late 1970s, early 1980s, you know, Deng Xiaoping started, I think, some rhetoric back behind the scenes, some conversations with Margaret Thatcher on handing Hong Kong over back to the Chinese. As you know, the British basically secured their rule over Hong Kong with a 99-year lease.
Yeah.
The Chinese wanted that lease to end in 1997 and threatened, I think, the British in one way or another to get them to do it a little sooner. And so while these negotiations were going on, word got out that the Chinese were talking to the British about a handover. And if you noticed what happened then, the Hong Kong currency had about a 50% decline versus both the dollar and the pound going into 1983.
Yeah.
And then in late 1983.
So it was a free floating currency then?
It was a free floating currency
right.
then. Yep. So, but a 50% deval over just a handful of years, to the extent that the South China Morning Post was saying it's becoming a banana republic, the currency's in a quote free fall, and then they pegged it to the dollar, the US dollar. fascinating, right? It's being controlled by the British, and yet they pegged it to the U.S. dollar,
yeah.
Looking for more stability than I guess the British had.
nice dig.
And now we face Brexit. God only knows what's going to happen next. But I think that back then they engaged in a peg to try to bring some sort of stability to calm the nerves and the psyches of investors in Southeast Asia and primarily Hong Kong. Because, as you know, investors were thinking with Great Britain, there's a legislative democracy. There's basically a financial stability. There's rule of law. There are all the things that capital needs to invest and make real investments in the sovereign or the territory. And with the idea that China might take back over sooner rather than later, the money left, and that's why they had to institute the peg. So the UK-Chinese agreement, the Sino-British agreement in 1984, stipulated or set forth the rules by which Great Britain would engage with Hong Kong in the future, and the handoff would be, July 1st, 1997. Fast forward from 84 to 92, when the U.S. entered its Hong Kong U.S. Policy Act. Both Great Britain and the U.S. treat Hong Kong as its own sovereign, mm-hmm. as long as it maintains autonomy in its economic affairs, in its legislative affairs, and in its rule of law.
What does autonomy mean?
That no one else is running the show.
Right. Okay.
This agreement stipulates that it is a special administrative region of China, but it will be treated as Hong Kong as long as those things are maintained. I'd love to cover that secondarily.
Yes, we'll come on to that
in our conversation. But
hence my question: what's autonomy?
But yeah, that's a bit. The word's very important.
Yeah.
So when you look at today, if you just look at Hong Kong from a macro perspective, it's really important to think about what happens when you peg your currency to another. Right, there's the pegged currency, then there's the anchor currency. The anchor currency in this case is the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing is you're basically saying, I will adopt their monetary policy. I'll adopt their yield curve, right? I will basically let Jesus take the wheel, mm-hmm. and let the U.S. run my economy. Now, that works actually fairly well as long as there's a synchronicity in economic outputs, right? Yep. I.e., if the economies are working together, if one grows, the other grows. If one goes into decline, the other goes into decline. That kind of relationship actually works.
Mm-hmm.
If one economy is growing while the other one's declining and you have to import monetary policy and i.e. the same rates curve, it's a disaster for the one that's declining.
Mm-hmm.
And so 36 years ago, the U.S. was the engine for the world.
Yeah.
And as the U.S. economy went, the world economy went.
Yeah.
There was synchronicity. And if you fast forward to China's ascension to WTO in 2001, China's move into becoming the second largest economy in the world with roughly 15% of GDP, and you look at the infrastructure build that China engaged in since 2001 in their southern ports, really southern and up the coast, what you see is Hong Kong used to be the biggest port in the world. They were a dollar-based goods exporter and re-exporter of goods for southern China. They were essentially China's southern port.
Yeah.
And they were very functionally relevant to China, especially in the early 1990s. They represented a quarter of China's GDP, actually almost 30% of China's GDP. Today it's 2.5%. So they were relatively unimportant, very important, and now unimportant again from an economic perspective.
Yeah.
Right? From a capital raising perspective, very important to China. But from an economic output perspective, not that important.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at how Hong Kong's economy has changed over the last 36 years, they've gone from a goods exporter and services importer. And right in the financial crisis, that flipped. And, we have a chart in here whereby you see the blue bars are goods. The red bars are services.
Total flip.
So it looks like the financial crisis flipped them, but that's just coincidental, actually. It was the southern port build-out that basically moved China's, ownership of the top 10 ports in the world from 9% in 2001 to 60% in 2015. So that's what happened in forcing Hong Kong to actually reinvent its economy. Hong Kong today is a massive net goods importer. It's hard to believe that.
Yeah.
and they're a services exporter, and they face China, right, for travel, for financial services, real estate services, legal services. Call it 80% plus of their economy relies on China on the export side of services, and they import dollar-based goods.
Right.
And so there's no lack of, there's no synchronicity between the two economies.
So they decoupled essentially from the U.S. economy.
Yeah. And so if you and I were running Hong Kong today and we said, how should we run our economy? We would say pegging to the dollar would not be the right idea.
Pegged to the RMB, I guess, if you can do it.
Yeah. And so their economic arrangement with the U.S. is one that has changed dramatically over 36 years, but on the face of the world, it actually hasn't changed at all yet. And then you look at the macro of Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
If you import U.S. monetary policy, as they went into 2008, right? In 2008, U.S. took rates to zero.
Yeah.
So historically, the anchor currency is the one that, let's say, is the fiscally responsible one. Yeah. It's the one that keeps inflation under control. It's the one that keeps rates where they should be. It keeps a more stable economy, and that's why people anchor to them. In this case, the inmate's now running the asylum. We just took rates to zero. Imagine this. 2008, U.S. takes rates to zero, so Hong Kong rates go to zero. And their largest trading partner, China, goes to the gas pedal. So the 10-year period from 08 to 2018 were the best 10 years that Hong Kong will ever see. Will never happen again. So no wonder real estate went up 500 to 700% in a 10-year period.
Hmm.
Right? No wonder the price of Hong Kong real estate is $10,000 a square foot.
And that's why that chart of services, because it all becomes finance. Because it just goes to money, right?
Well, it's free money.
That's right.
And your largest trading partner is growing double digits.
Yeah.
And so what happened? The Chinese came in with all their money they were making and bought all the real estate in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So now it's completely unaffordable. I think, you know, the most expensive real estate in the world. And what's interesting is the Hong Kong banking system did exactly what Iceland, Ireland, and Cyprus did. The Hong Kong banking system is now almost nine times their GDP.
Wow.
What was the common denominator of the countries that fell apart in the European crisis? They fell like dominoes. It was the size of their banking system when they hit a slight recession.
Yeah.
Broke the country, right? Because the country has to go in and save the banks, save depositors, and that means the sovereign has to lend into the banks, and it breaks the sovereign because the banks are hyper-levered to the GDP.
But what have they lent against in Hong Kong? Because this has got to be the key, right?
So this
the
USA
is the housing market.
This is the fun one. So of the, call it today, it's 850% of GDP. 280% of GDP of the 850 is lent to Chinese property developers into China.
Wow.
The rest is lent to domestic SMEs and mortgages. So I hear a lot from the various sell-side firms that we call. They say, oh, Hong Kong mortgages, they're only 50% loan-to-value, not a problem. I said, really? How do they afford a 50% deposit on the most expensive real estate in the world? They said, oh, that's easy. So the bank lends 50. The property developers lend 35 in a second lien. And families, the families or friends lend them the other 15. I said, so how does that work? And they said, well, that's easy because, you know, housing goes up like 10 to 15% a year. So in the first year, this is a partner at one of the biggest firms in the world tells me this, that runs the real estate business. In the first year, they refi their family out. And in the next 2 years, they refi the developers out, and then they have a 50% LTV loan. I said, but what if prices go down? He said, oh, yeah, prices don't go down. Literally, I'm hearing this again.
We've heard this before.
Right? And so there's this belief that the loans in the banking system are safe because of their loan-to-value ratios. I think we all know that that's not going to be true.
So of the Hong Kong money, the banking system, is most of that debt?
Oh, yeah.
Debt in China.
Oh, yeah.
Chinese debt.
Yes.
There's nothing to do with the Hong Kong domestics or...
Oh, no, no. So 280, so of the 850, 280 is lent to China. The balance is lent to Hong Kong domestics.
Right. What the hell do they do with it all? Because there's not that many people in Hong Kong.
Private sector financial credit is the highest of any developed nation in the world. 300% of GDP. Look at the U.S. and Japan and look at where Hong Kong is.
Wow.
So you have the most levered banking system in the world.
Is there not some weird mechanism that is flowing back into China? Just feels that you don't look at the streets of Hong Kong and think everyone's completely borrowed as much money as the eyeballs. It feels like there's another mechanism.
Well, they could have taken the money and invested it in China, right? Mm. I mean, what I'm saying is domestic private sector credit to GDP is 300%. Banking assets to GDP are 850. So they're the most levered nation in the world with the most expensive real estate in the world with an economic arrangement with a country that is no longer synchronized.
Right.
It is a recipe for disaster.
So everyone's going to have in their head, yeah, I heard this all before in 98, and everyone got every hedge fund who tried to take advantage of that peg breaking didn't break. What's going on now that's different? Because you've looked at reserves and a whole number of different things.
Yeah, let's talk about 98 first. I think it's important to see the HKMA had a decision to make, right? Either revalue the peg or suffer a massive debt deflation.
Yeah.
And now their debt was nowhere near what it is today. But what they did, if you look at this chart here, from July 2nd, 1997, which is when the Thai baht broke the peg, interestingly enough, one day after the handoff from the Brits to the Chinese, July 1st, 97 was the day of the handoff. July 2nd was when the Thai baht broke. Hmm. It's not coincidental. So from July 2nd of 97 to the beginning of 2003, Hong Kong real estate dropped 70% in value.
Wow.
Right? So they elected to take a multi-year, enormous, basically deflation-led depression.
Yeah.
So the way that they made that election during the crisis of 97, 98 is they spiked overnight rates up to 20%.
That's right.
So U.S. rates were 4.5%, 5%. Right? So they took rates from 5 to 20 on a spike to thwart any currency from leaving. They were trying to keep currency there, right? Well, today, the fascinating thing about their banking system, their mortgages, their assets, their loans in their system, the substantial majority of all of those loans indexes to one-month HIBOR, their overnight lending rate, and they all reset every month.
Right.
So imagine taking an economy at max leverage and raising rates to keep currency from leaving.
Impossible.
That arrow is out of the quiver. They can't do it this time. So if you look at the IMF's Article 4 review of Hong Kong, the number one risk is the fact that all the loans are floating and indexed to one-month HIBOR.
It's the same with the UK back in the sterling crisis.
Mm.
Because all UK properties borrowed at the short-term rate.
Right. Same with Hong Kong. Now, they have a mechanism in their mortgage market that has a cap at prime minus a rate, call it 250.
Yeah.
Prime's like 5.
Yeah.
And so the Hong Kongers believe that even though their rates have gone from an effective 1.25% or 1.5% to 2.5%, that there's a cap. So the most fascinating thing was in September of 2018, I think it was September 29th, was the day the Fed raised rates. That night, Hong Kong raised the prime lending rate by 12.5 basis points. That's it. The next week, the South China Morning Post ran stories every day talking about real estate dropping 6 to 10% in a week because all of a sudden the Hong Kongers figured out that the cap could move.
Hmm.
Right? You can't just move base lending rate. You have to move prime.
Yeah.
If rates are going to move up.
Yeah.
So 12.5 bit move on the prime lending rate scared the entirety of the Hong Kong real estate market.
Wow.
That's why you see that hook down there at the end of this chart.
Yeah.
That started the end of September.
So then the other preconception is right now, same as it was back then, is Hong Kong has unlimited balance sheet, the HKMA.
Mm.
You know, because even I'm burnt by the HKMA because, you know, they even bought the equity market.
They did.
They did. I mean, they killed everybody. Every hedge fund, you can talk to Paul Tudor Jones, Lewis Bacon, a whole lot of them are like, no, I don't want to fight these guys. So talk to me about the HKMA, what the options they've got in this situation.
Well, let's talk about Norman Chan, right? The head of the HKMA. He's going to retire here in the next 4 or 5 months.
Right.
So they're going to look for new leadership. As far as the HKMA and this idea that is, let's say, talked about by the sell side a lot with regard to they have a pile of dollar-based reserves. They have what they call a perfect currency board. For every 7.8 Hong Kong dollars in the system, there's a dollar in the system.
Yeah.
And they've got more than their entire GDP in money in circulation, everything's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about that, if currency boards worked, then Argentina, which used to be 1-to-1 to the U.S. dollar in 2001, just think about this, 2001, 17 years ago, 18 years ago now, it was 1-to-1. You know what it is? We know what it is today, 43-to-1, maybe 44. Who knows what it is today?
Exactly.
Right? When you look at a currency board or you look at a currency peg, let's say that identity is true. For every 7.8 Hong Kong dollars in the system, there's one U.S. dollar in the system. You can't take it below that and run a fractional reserve peg. I guess you can, but you'd lose confidence would be lost very quickly.
Yeah.
And so the way we look at it as currency in circulation, which you can't really, let's just say, go into. You can't go into that cookie jar. You have to stay out with your excess reserves. So yeah. Hong Kong reports every night what their excess reserves are. They call it their aggregate balance.
Right.
And just 2 years ago, that was about 170 billion Hong Kong dollars. It was real money.
Yeah.
In the last year, they've spent 80% of that money defending the peg. 80.
Wow.
They have 50 billion Hong Kong dollars left. Call it 6 billion U.S. dollars left before all of a sudden they're going to have to make a decision. Now, can they go find some other money in their economy somewhere, somehow, to keep defending the peg? This actually goes back to this concept of even sovereign default. And if you and I are running a sovereign or you and I are running a peg, it's actually similar. Do we think that it's anomalous that this attack is speculators? Or is it the macro economy telling us that maybe the peg's not pegged to the right thing?
Yeah.
And maybe not the value is the right value.
Yeah.
Right? Is it temporary or is it a secular problem?
See, in 98, what was different is everybody was under pressure.
Yes.
It wasn't Hong Kong's
problem. Exactly right.
But nobody's
under pressure. And it wasn't Hong Kong's leverage either. And it wasn't Hong Kong's housing market.
No.
Or banks.
No.
It was people running into dollars, afraid of China taking over the region. And so now you have this hyper-levered system in the most expensive real estate market in the world. You have the natural move. So right now, if the Hong Kong dollar and U.S. dollar are interchangeable, which freely interchangeable, which they are at the peg, you can earn 83 basis points more on an overnight rate if you just have a dollar deposit. So if I ask you, Raul, would you rather have 1% or 2% on your deposits?
Yeah.
And it's freely interchangeable.
That's right.
You don't have to be a genius to figure that one out.
So
that's why the pressure continues to mount and mount and mount. People are just converting to dollars.
So I don't think many people will be aware of what's actually going on in the Hong Kong currency. Explain a bit about the situation of what's been going on and how it's been trading versus the peg.
So it has a very narrow band. So the peg was set in 83. They adjusted it to a band. The band is 7.75 to 7.85 to the dollar.
Yeah.
It's basically a little more than a 1% band.
Yeah.
And so for the last few years, it's traded at the strong side of the band. And in the last 1 year, it's traded to the weak side, the 7.85 to the dollar. And
but
so what happens when it's
a flat line there, though?
But what happens is if you're going to maintain a hard edge like they have to maintain, they have to sell dollars and buy their own currency. So they have to sell their rainy day fund, their excess dollars they have to sell. So they've sold 80% of those dollars in a year's time. Just think about that. So what happens when they sell the last 20%? So two things happen. Either they find more dollars by mortgaging or leveraging another asset or requisitioning funds from somewhere. It's not the only money they have.
Sure.
And we've done a very in-depth analysis, not in our letter. We can cover that another day. But let's just say they have a decision to make. They can raise rates up to the level where they stop the currency from running, i.e. converting to dollars, or they can find some more money to fight the peg with.
Now, the other question is this is clearly tied into the Chinese story.
Coming up next is a conversation between Alex Jones and Lord Monckton. And what's happening right now is that we see that at the late 1700s in France, there were two revolutions going on. There was a national state revolution, and there was a socialist communist revolution going on. The big money, capitalism, won out over the socialist communist worldwide, even though there were successful revolutions in Russia and eventually China in the 40s. But what we're seeing now is a tremendous protest movement, and Hong Kong would be an example of that. You could say Italy, Spain, Argentina. You could say, you know, Venezuela down there is also. And through other places in Europe, in England, and there's America elected Trump. So there's a move back to the nation state, but the internationalists are against that totally. So here we have a very insightful conversation with Alex Jones and Lord Monckton. Here we go now.
Paul Watson, obviously, works for these guys, some behind the scenes. He tells me that Nigel Farage really is the not to lessen Boris Johnson, but he's really one of the chief advisors to Johnson, and that's got the system really scared.
Well, certainly, Nigel, you see, having set up his own Brexit party, is really saying to Boris, look, if you don't deliver Brexit by the due date, if you're forced into any kind of a general election before you've managed to leave the European Union, then we in the Brexit Party are going to be standing not with you, but against you. I call this age the New Enlightenment. We had the Age of Enlightenment, then came the Age of Communism, Fascism and Socialism, various kinds of totalitarianism. Now, the people who love democracy in Hong Kong, in Germany, in Britain, in Italy, in many parts of the world, and of course America, having elected Donald Trump, now the people are rising up against those who would impose a global socialist, communist, fascist tyranny upon us. And of course, these words, socialist, communist, fascist, they sound extreme, but they are unfortunately realistic.
And believe it, the world is hungry for liberty. And once again, the West, the United Kingdom, the United States, just as we saw in World War I and World War II, is leading the way out of tyranny against the Chi-Coms, the corrupt EU. History doesn't just rhyme, it repeats. The question is, which side will Russia get with in this major political realignment? When the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth II, for the first time in 400 years suspended Parliament, it wasn't because a king or a queen wanted to ignore the will of the people. It was because the people had voted to leave an unelected tyranny almost 4 years ago, and it had their demands ignored and scuttled. And thanks to Lord Christopher Monckton and Nigel Farage at the heart of this movement at Brexit, we now see her doing the right thing. And this has sent shockwaves. This is just like the realignment in World War II and Bretton Woods that came after it, in my humble opinion. Lord Christopher Monckton has been the top advisor to Margaret Thatcher, author, the preeminent scientist and expert working with other scientists around the world, proving man-made global warming is a fraud and a globalist takeover. He has What's Up With That website and, of course, his Science and Public Policy site. But I wanted to get him on to correct me if I'm wrong, that you cannot underestimate how seismic this is, what it really symbolizes, India going into Kashmir, which the Islamics have been taking, China's been moving in, that's a proxy war, China moving into Hong Kong. I mean, the world is going into the type of constellations, the type of alignments that we saw before World War One and World War Two. Am I right in saying that, and are we not seeing the classic alignments line up again, Lord Monckton?
What is happening is that, let's take Hong Kong first of all, yes, the people of Hong Kong were guaranteed certain rights under the agreement between China and Britain over the handover of Hong Kong. In my view, we shouldn't have handed it over to that particular regime. We didn't have to. There was no obligation to. But we decided to, unfortunately. And the people of Hong Kong are now missing the freedoms they had under British rule, which was a great deal freer than Chinese rule. And in the United Kingdom, where we have been struggling for 40 years to break free from the tyranny by Clark, which is the European Union, Boris Johnson, who is our very new prime minister, has decided, and rightly, that we can no longer allow Parliament to get in the way of the people's will as expressed in an overwhelming referendum vote by a clear majority of 1¾ million 3 or 4 years ago, by which we voted to leave the tyranny by clerk and once again get our democracy back. That's what we voted for. Parliament wasn't going to let us. And so what Boris has done is to say, all right, we're going to give Parliament enough time to debate this, but not enough to wreck it. And of course, all of the smelly socks, all the people who are trying to deny us democracy are rushing to the courts in Scotland, in Ireland, and in London, all of them demanding that the Queen's decision to prorogue Parliament should be set aside by the mere courts. Well, the mere courts are going to find that they have no power to interfere with Her Majesty's prerogative. She has decided to take the advice of her Prime Minister, as she is entitled and indeed constitutionally bound to do, that therefore she has decided that Parliament will be prorogued for slightly longer, only about a week longer than it's normally prorogued for. It's not new. It's not the first time in 400 years. This happens every year. In fact, the present Parliament has gone on for far longer than any Parliament in the last 400 years. So it's appropriate that it should be prorogued.
Let me just interrupt. I know you're the parliamentary expert. I'm not about to disagree with you, but correct me if I'm wrong. Something this dramatic, though, hasn't happened in 400. Clearly, when the King of England told Neville Chamberlain to step down and put Winston Churchill in, that was another move saying, look, this Parliament has been siding with Hitler. You're done. You're a bunch of wimps. Winston Churchill's in. So wouldn't that be another dramatic time that something similar in the same family has happened?
Well, the first thing to realize is that it is at the Prime Minister's instigation and not at the monarch's instigation that this prorogation has happened. It's an entirely normal constitutional procedure where the Prime Minister goes to see the Queen with the Leader of the Commons, in this case, the wonderful Jacob Rees-Mogg, one of my neighbours down here, and they said, look, we want to prorogue Parliament, have a new Parliament, which will start on October the 14th, which is two and a half clear weeks before Halloween, the day on which we actually leave. And in any case, there's another 2 weeks before Parliament is prorogued. So there's plenty of time.
I understand, but we'll get to this next segment. You're the expert. Boil it down, though. Am I right that this is a huge seismic shift, though, looking like we will get a good, clean Brexit and a huge defeat to the EU tyranny?
Well, the EU tyranny won't like what's happened, and those who support it certainly don't like what's happened. There are demonstrations, there's a lot of screaming, the BBC is wetting itself, taking only one side, of course. But what has happened is entirely constitutionally proper. The courts have no power to intervene, to tell Her Majesty she should not prorogue Parliament, and therefore I suspect that Boris will get away with that. Parliament still has plenty of time, though, to try to bring forward a wrecking bill, and that's the first thing that Oliver Leftwing and various other characters like that are going to try. He was on the television today saying he was going to do that. So this is by no means a done deal yet, but what you can see very clearly is that Boris Johnson speaks for Britain. As President Trump has recently said, Boris Johnson loves this country very much, as of course does Donald Trump. He's a great admirer of Britain, and he sees in Boris Johnson somebody who stands up for this country and for the majority of the people of this country that voted to leave the tyranny by clerk and once again be an independent nation. Boris now speaks for the people of Britain. He has gambled a lot by taking this brave move, but I think that gamble is going to pay off. He's going to be successful.
And he's delivering on what he said he would do. And Paul Watson obviously works for these guys, some behind the scenes. He tells me that Nigel Farage really is the not to lessen Boris Johnson, but he's really one of the chief advisors to Johnson, and that's got the system really scared.
Well, certainly, Nigel, you see, having set up his own Brexit party, is really saying to Boris, look, if you don't deliver Brexit by the due date, if you're forced into any kind of a general election before you've managed to leave the European Union, then we and the Brexit party are going to be standing not with you, but against you. So Boris is under a lot of pressure to do what Theresa May faffed around not doing and get us out of the European Union. The technique that he's using behind the scenes, and of course Sir Oliver Leftwing and people like that haven't noticed yet, is in fact a very clever one. What he's doing is a series of what are called micro deals.
Hold on, stay there. We got to go to break. This is history happening from, you know, UKIP and now the Brexit Party, nothing 20 years ago, to the dominant growing party in Europe, the UK. This is truly liberty marching on, a human awakening. It's a very beautiful time. Lord Monckton is our guest. We'll come right back with him on the other side of this quick break to get into what's happening behind the scenes. Lord Christopher Monckton of Brensley, super patriot, fighting the globalist on every front. I want to get more into Brexit, the huge fight, Hong Kong, India, Kashmir, because I know you're a geopolitical thinker. What would you call this period the world's in with nationalism exploding, Germany with nationalists set to take over? It's happening everywhere, but they're striking back with censorship. They're striking back with leftist violence. I mean, I agree we're not out of the woods yet, but seeing this huge awakening, what would you call this period? And then, well, first, let's get to what you were trying to hit before the break. The real power behind the throne, we're not sycophantically talking about it. It's true. It's admitted. Nigel Farage and his Brexit party keeping Boris Johnson very, very honest. I've got headlines here about Boris Johnson doesn't turn out to be a buffoon. He turns out to be a deadly tactician. Well, there's a really deadly tactician behind this named Nigel Farage. And, of course, you're involved in that as well. We're not saying that from a bragging position, but you can give us the real inside intel globally right now on what's happening.
Let's start just first of all with what Boris is going to do to get Brexit. Then I'll move on to Nigel Farage. Then we'll move on a bit round the world because the point you're making is a very important one. I call this age the new enlightenment. We had the age of enlightenment. Then came the age of communism, fascism and socialism, various kinds of totalitarianism. Now the people who love democracy in Hong Kong, in Germany, in Britain, in Italy, in many parts of the world, and of course America, having elected Donald Trump. Now the people are rising up against those who would impose a global socialist, communist, fascist tyranny upon us. And of course, these words, socialist, communist, fascist, they sound extreme, but they are unfortunately realistic. Let's start with Boris Johnson then. Boris is doing a series of micro deals on all the areas of trade, which would be disrupted if we left the European Union on the 31st of October, the due date, without a trade deal, such as pharmaceuticals and agriculture. These are two of the big ones. Motor manufacture is another. And these areas, which could prove sensitive if we didn't make individual temporary arrangements, he is making sure that those individual temporary arrangements are in place so that if we leave without a comprehensive trade deal, and that's what the normal rules of leaving the European Union would expect, you leave without a comprehensive deal, and then once you're out, you negotiate it. And all that Boris is doing is putting things in place so that if we leave without a comprehensive deal, we do not leave with dislocation and bankruptcy for businesses and disruption of trade and queues of lorries halfway from London to Dover. Those things are not going to happen because the government under Boris Johnson is making very clear and very sure that they won't happen. So don't worry about a no-deal Brexit being somehow hugely disruptive. It won't be, because everything that might be disruptive is being dealt with behind the scenes very quickly, very efficiently by Boris and his team. Now we come to Nigel Farage, and Farage is putting proper pressure on Boris, and for once also, he's now looking at a wider issue than just the question of leaving the European dictatorship. Because one of the things that's become apparent to you and to him and to me, Alex, is that if we're going to keep democracy in any recognizable sense at all, there are various steps we're going to have to take the battle right to the front line where the other side are. For instance, in the universities, where now there is a denial of freedom of speech, we're going to have to say to those universities, you either permit freedom of speech, you permit both sides to be heard on questions such as climate change, on whether Britain leaves the EU, on whether Mr. Trump is a good thing or a bad one. You allow both sides to be heard, or we will take your charter, your funding, and your recognition as a university away.
And Trump, taking your lead, has signed an executive order starting just that. and the universities are having to back down. But we have to go demand the right to speak. You parachuted into South Africa when the UN banned you from the UN conference. You parachuted into it. So you're putting your money where your mouth is.
Well, that's right. The great thing, being Irish, I knew that if I threw myself to the ground, I wouldn't miss. So all was well. But it did make sure that they had to let me back into the conference. And then I produced a report of what they were really up to at that conference, which we put up at whatsupwiththat.com. And that was the top posting out of 500,000 postings on all subjects that day of all the blog posts from WordPress, which manages most of the blog posts around the world, because so popular was it. I was the only journalist who actually went in there, found out what was really going on, and reported it, rather than simply blowing sunshine up the backsides of the UN. There's a picture of me now, as you can see, grinning from ear to ear as I leap happily out of the plane and head rapidly towards the ground in the Drakensberg Mountains of South Africa. It was a wonderful moment, and what a beautiful country it is. So we are fighting, Alex, against this tide of, you can call it communism, fascism, socialism, totalitarianism, or to use the ancient
centralized
Chinese
term corporate legally. Totalitarianism allied with the Chi-Coms, and it's becoming very evident that the Chi-Coms are the great driving engine and the force to which all these mega corporations and the Googles of the world are using for the funding of Hollywood, for the espionage, and Trump and others are starting to take the gloves off recognizing the espionage.
There we go with it, the ending of that. You'll be able to pick it up on the web, on YouTube, and I'll give some click-offs on thesecrettruth.com. So come in there to thesecrettruth.com, and I'll have click-offs where you can listen to this whole interview of Alex Jones and Lord Monckton. What we're seeing now, you have to say, focus in on the Hong Kong. There are students there. They're for liberty and freedom. They're carrying American flags. You've got unrest in different places. Greece had it earlier, a few years ago. Spain, you've had unrest there in Barcelona area. Italy, you've got Hungary. You've got UK with this Brexit movement. But you have a lot of different movements. They're freedom movements, and they're for freedom and liberty throughout the world. And that's what we're undergoing right now. And this is what we must try to protect. And that's why the Hong Kong freedom movement is so important, is that we must come behind those students and workers and whoever, business people in Hong Kong, and support them fully. Now, earlier in this program, we covered money problems in Hong Kong. Mark Carney is advocating some new digital currency, synthetic hegemonic money is what they're talking about. I think it's a comeback, it's a blowback or whatever to the Bitcoin. And then also, China right now is recruiting people that know about cyber currencies, and so they're out there recruiting right now and trying to gather together. But their angle is, how can they continue to control the money? And I think that's the same problem that the city of London is having, which characteristically for several hundred years has been very dominant in money in the world. And they're trying to figure out, let's float this digital currency, hegemonic synthetic money currency, and try to stay ahead of the curve. But this thing is exploding with the internet and the freedom of trade directly from person to person. It's really changing up things greatly. But I want to thank everyone for listening out there. And we're just trying to bring a little understanding to this whole situation. And it's not always, it's sad. There are sad field moments out there that we've tried to work through. And work through into some kind of more meaningful way. Thank you, and God bless each and every one of you in our listening audience. And we're trying to make things happen and make things work for the good. Thank you. Good night.